And welcome to the double feature double cross. I keep forgetting, man. That's the third time in a row I've done that. I have not double crossed you guys yet. I shouldn't be laughing like that. Welcome to the show. I'm John O'Connor. This is a podcast where I review something I like, and then on the other half of the episode, I review a movie that I have lied about seeing. And I've lied about seeing almost every movie I've ever talked about, because I hate being judged by people over and over and over for not having the same life as them. You've never seen Goonies? Well, no. I mean, yes, I have now, because that person bought me a DVD. Because they were so outraged I had not seen Goonies, I got it for my birthday. I will say, thanks, Melissa. Great movie. Loved it. I was only 23 or 4 by the time I finally saw it. I was a little sheltered growing up. Anyway, thanks for tuning in again for the third installment. Again, people have been really cool about the first couple of episodes, so I'm going to keep these coming. This week, I've got a two-parter again, like every week, and that was redundant. I don't know why I had to say all that. This week I'll be reviewing two things, the first of which is a movie I have lied about seeing only a few times. I've seen some of this other person's movies and I really did enjoy them, so this week my buddy Joe let me borrow a movie, and I specifically told him I was going to do this movie for the podcast. So this week I will be reviewing 2001: A Space Odyssey. I'll get into that in a minute. The other thing that I'm going to review is my all-time favorite comedy special in history, which is Bill Hicks' One Night Stand. So get ready, buckle it up, and enjoy the ride, baby. All right, so this week, 2001: A Space Odyssey. I've seen this movie like everywhere. I've never actually seen the movie. I've seen it now, of course, because I watched it, but I had never seen the movie before. I'd heard a lot of people talk about it, especially since it's Stanley Kubrick, and that guy produced all of these other, or not produced, but directed. He made a bunch of awesome movies, including Full Metal Jacket. Man, I know he did Eyes Wide Shut, which is a movie I hated. So we've got, I know he's got a bunch of other stuff, Clockwork Orange, I knew, 2001, Eyes Wide Shut, Full Metal Jacket, The Shining. So he's done a handful of cool movies there, very highly revered, most of them. And I'd heard a lot of stuff about 2001, so I was very excited to watch it. So when I finally sat down, immediately when you turn on the, well, first I should just say 2001: A Space Odyssey was released in 1968, which some of the effects in the movie, when you watch it, it's like, oh shit, like they don't mean anything to you now, but you got to realize back not long after color TV was invented, some of the effects were were pretty awesome. So anyway, the way the movie starts, when you put it in, when you start watching, I put it in, because like, obviously you got to put it into the DVD player, or you could download it somewhere, but I had a Blu-ray. So the way the movie starts is just a black screen, and it's kind of got this, I don't know how to explain the music, but it's got like this swell of music that slowly builds up into something. And it's kind of ominous, it's kind of jarring a little bit, but eventually it becomes beautiful and very pretty, and then you go, oh, okay, that's nice, and then all of a sudden back to the spooky shit, so, which is kind of how the whole movie goes. I think it's 9 minutes, I don't know if I have that correct. I wrote that down, but I feel like that might be wrong, but either way, something like 9 minutes of, or maybe it's only a few minutes of black screen and this music before. That's before all the stuff rolls up. That's before the MGM logo comes up and all that jazz. So the movie starts with the theme for 2001, A Space Odyssey. And it's this beautiful shot. It's outer space. It's all this crazy stuff. It's also the music of Nature Boy Ric Flair. So in my head, I'm just like, woo! Because I'm a hack. I go to the first thing. So Ric Flair comes strutting out. No, he doesn't. But I wish he had. It would have been cool dropping some elbows. I would have liked that. Nonetheless, even though Ric Flair was not in the movie, sorry, spoiler alert, even though he wasn't in the movie itself was really, really cool. It starts out, it's weird, it's a weird movie, well, I shouldn't say weird, well, it is weird, but that wasn't its predominant feature. It was just unique. It was unlike any movie I'd ever seen. It kind of marched to its own beat. It really didn't give a shit what you wanted. Just did whatever it wanted. And I like that. I like a movie that's different than all the other movies you see. And this one was definitely very different. The way it starts out, it's all these beautiful shots of like space and then landscapes and all this other stuff. And eventually get this little script across the bottom of the screen there that says The Dawn of Man. And there's all these monkeys kind of foraging around in these little rock formations and caves and stuff. And then we got these little other animals with them. They're not real. They're like, they're about the size of like a pig or something, but they, I don't know, they look kind of like a horse and a pig together, I guess. They look more like a pig. They're fatter, stockier like a pig, but their heads are kind of almost like a little bit of a horse in a way, I guess. So those were, that's kind of all you see is these monkeys and these pig horses. Which, yeah, it's fun to watch them race, but they're all, you know, it's just kind of chopped together, all these monkeys and pig horses, and then all of a sudden, boom, leopard just jumps out of the tree, takes down one of the monkeys. Nature. So, yeah, I guess that's it. It's just to show you what life was like at the dawn of man. Here are all these monkeys. They're obviously people in monkey costumes, but, yeah, one of them gets picked off by a leopard, which I'm still amazed. I still don't know how they did it. If it was an effect or if they just paid somebody to go in like a reinforced suit and get pounced on by a leopard. I don't know how it worked. But anyway, leopard smashes the monkey. And eventually, at one point, this like little team of monkeys, I guess, I don't know what you would call a group, so I'll call them a team. The little team of monkeys goes up to this watering hole, and they run into this other watering hole monkey group, and they all start barking at each other and screeching. And it's like a monkey's watering hole West Side Story. It's pretty awesome. They just kind of yell at each other. It's just a standoff, basically. And then a few more cuts, a few more monkey cuts, and all of a sudden, boom, the famous black slate, the monolith, which isn't really explained in the film. Or if it is, it's up open to interpretation, and I was too dumb to understand what it was. But there it is. I've seen it in some other stuff. I'm pretty sure it was in The Simpsons and stuff like that. So I don't know how to explain it except to say that it's a black rectangle, perfectly cut, like perfect dimensions. It looks smooth. Looks like it's probably cool to the touch. I don't know what it's made out of. They don't really explain what it is. It's just there. But this black monolith, after the monkeys are there looking at it, they end up, one of them gets an idea. And he's sitting in this little pile of bones, and then he realizes, like, oh, I could use this bone to smash stuff. So then he starts smashing other bones. Then he starts smashing pig horses. It's all kind of mash cut together. Pig horses and skulls, and next thing you know, they're eating all this dangly meat. There's all these monkeys just holding this dangly meat in their hands and from their mouths. It's like an entire shower curtain worth of meat. And then, after they smash all the pig horses and the skulls and the other things, then you see some baby monkeys, and the baby monkeys are using the tools too, you know, because once you know how to kill people, you know, got to start them young, got to get them out there. So now the baby monkeys know how to use bones, and now the other monkeys know how to use bones as weapons. So they go back to the watering hole to talk to Chino. And let me tell you something. These monkey sharks with the bones, these guys kick the shit out of those poor boneless monkey jets. It's evolution, baby. Just that's what happens. You don't have... That's why we need guns, because they might come with bones. So that's kind of the end of that scene. It was a long scene. It was probably 10, 15, 20 minutes, I don't know. And then the end of that scene, now it cuts to Princess Leia's ship in outer space, which is impressive because this is before Star Wars even came out. I don't know how Kubrick knew it. He must have talked to, all right, before I get any hate mail, obviously I know this is not Princess Leia's ship. It's just a ship that kind of looks like it. And you see a space station, another space shuttle. They're kind of floating through space there. It's very beautiful. Most of the whole movie is very, very beautiful. Very beautiful shots. Very vivid colors and stuff. It was really cool. And while they're floating through space, there's this music. I don't know if it's the Blue Danube. I think it might be. It was basically every single cartoon I ever heard, you know, watched that was made before 1980 used this music. So now you have a shot of this row of seats, and the camera's in the aisle, and it's looking up the aisle. And it looks basically exactly like a modern-day plane. There are all these seats lined up. They're all empty, except you can see one guy's arm or his legs, I forget, hanging out of the side. They all have TV screens and the headrests. Kind of creepy that they... Not creepy, but I don't know if creepy is the right word. Nice vision, though. I mean, the only difference is that it looks like a modern-day airplane, except instead this is a space shuttle in outer space, so kind of close, I guess. So then you see this pen, like, floating through space very slowly, just tumbling through space. And at the time, this was like, you know, 1968. These effects were unbelievable, like unparalleled. Nothing had ever even looked like this before in a movie, so it's pretty cool to see. I don't know if you guys can hear, but every fire truck in the United States of America is driving down my street, so hopefully that's picking up so you guys get a nice background sound effect for no reason. As this guy's sleeping, this pen is tumbling through air. This lady in this pure white, it's very sterile. It's this like white stewardess type of suit and like a turban, which was apparently in the future, that's what they were going to wear. Turbans were going to be the big thing. And she comes in wearing a pair of grip shoes. And I think the grip shoes are actually labeled grip shoes because, of course, zero gravity, you need to have your grip shoes. And if they're grip shoes, you want to make sure that you know, oh, these are those grip shoes. So, and to be fair, how would you convey that in a movie without having grip shoes printed right on the side? Actually, I don't remember if they were. I feel like it said grip shoes on the shoes. But anyway, the lady in the white jeweled space turban puts the pen back in the guy's pocket, and it cuts to the cockpit. It's being flown by two pilots, and now we're, like, tumbling towards this space station. And they have this IBM navigation system, which I was like, oh, man, that was a good guess. I really would have said, like, I think that's a good guess. I don't know if IBM does make navigation systems, but I don't think they look like this one if they do. It looked like the targeting computer, Luke, used in the X-Wing. I don't know if you remember that in Star Wars. So now the shuttle and the space station, they start doing this, like, synchronized, like, space swimming. Well, I think it's now the Blue Danube playing as they're, like, tumbling through space. It's all very beautiful. Now we cut to another attendant or stewardess. I don't know what you would call her. Now she's in, like, a pink, cotton candy pink outfit. And she's on this circular leather couch, and so is the dude with the pen. He's just sitting there in a suit. He's got his briefcase, and at this point, you see the first line of spoken dialogue. It's at like 25 minutes and 43 seconds, something like that, and it comes from the pink lady over there. She's this round leather couch thing is apparently like a mechanism for travel. I don't know if it's an elevator or whatever, but she, you know, all of a sudden the door slides open and the guy gets up and he walks out. So anyway, Penn, he checks in to meet with Mr. Charcoal suit. Then he checks in on a TV with this lady. I don't know how it worked. It was like a button mechanism. They had to press it and enter all this information. Surname first, then Christian name, nationality, destination. Like, he had to list them all out. Now, there's a kind of a modern-looking room with a Howard Johnson's, which I was kind of shocked about. It said it right there in the lobby. And then they had this picture phone. So Penn leaves the charcoal guy. He goes and puts basically a PlayStation 2 memory card into a ColecoVision, punches up a code, and a little girl appears on the screen. And now you realize they are on a picture phone. So this little girl apparently plays in front of the picture phone at all times in case her dad calls. And he actually, they have a conversation, and they realize that it's revealed that he's missing his daughter's birthday. He's in outer space for that, so that's kind of a bummer. And what was funny was the little girl said, like, thanks for, maybe you should telephone. And I loved that she used telephone as a predicate. Whenever you can use an object as a predicate or as a verb, I should say, I always enjoy that. And I think the call only cost them $1.70. Not bad. It's a good rate from outer space. Calling back to jolly old London. So Penn joins three ladies and a dude, and they start asking him questions. What's going on Clavius? 10 days. One of their rocket buses was denied landing at Clavius. I might be saying that wrong. It might be Clarius. I can't read my writing. But I think it's Clavius. 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 That's a bone, right? It's you Clavius. I broke my Clavius. So anyway, they land at Clavius. But there's some kind of violation. So they're like, hey, is there an epidemic? Are people dying up there? And of course, Penn's like, I can't discuss this. But come on back. We'd love to have you at Clavius. So he gives them a standing invitation to the United States or whatever, something like that. And then he takes an escape pod to the moon. Not like he runs out and escapes. He takes a escape pod-looking thing. So now there are two stewardesses enjoying some space juice boxes off of a tray that looks like a Guess Who board game. One of them walks in. Oh. Right here is like a crazy shot where like one of them walks in a ring. She like walks around the screen, which it's so hard to go back. You have to like take your mind and be like, oh, I forget all these incredible summer blockbusters I've seen where most of the film is a cartoon. This lady's walking on the ceiling. Magnificent. So, I mean, they were crazy effects for the time. She just got used to the grip shoes, I guess. She takes her space Guess Who juice to the cockpit, which is lit up in red like a photo lab. Two trays there, for one for each pilot. Everything, I don't know why, everything they eat in this movie is on a tray. And it's all divided into, like, equal colors and portions. It's like, here's my chicken, here's my green shit, I don't know, some kind of peas maybe. Here's my potatoes, here's my squash. It's all on an equally spaced tray. So anyway, they bring two spaced Guess Who juice boxes on trays up to the cockpit, into the photo lab cockpit for the pilots. Two trays, one for each pilot. So Penn is sitting there drinking down some Guess Who. And what I love is it's a tray with eight foods in straws, but everyone holds the trays up to their faces to drink the juices because the straws are so short. So here they are on a space station or a space shuttle that's on its way to a space station, but nobody figured out, like, hey, maybe make the straws longer so I don't have to carry a lunch tray up pressed under my chin as if I'm smelling a delicious meal. So, I don't know. Apparently, long straws were too advanced of an idea for people aboard the spaceship. So anyway, the captain walks in. But then Penn's tray almost floats away. But he catches it. Don't worry, guys. He caught his Guess Who space juice. So now it cuts to a sign, and it's all caps, and it says, Zero Gravity Toilet. Please read instructions before use. And it's a lot of instructions, like a whole, it's like as the instructions list is like as tall as Penn. It's totally, it's a long list. It's like the iTunes user agreement, really long. It's like 10, I don't know, not 10 feet tall, but it's like tiny font too, really tiny font. It's like, I don't know. It's the same size font as it would be if you were reading part of the Old Testament. And there are 10 of them, 10 steps to use the space toilet. Now, I mean, you would, if you're in space, you'd think they'd, like, go over how to go to the bathroom before you got there. Like, wait, what do I have to do if I have to take a shit? Ah, don't worry. When you get there, they tell you how to shit in space. Penn is reading the instructions. They go to the moon. They pull up to the moon. A few people on the surface walk around in spacesuits. All this, by the way, basically every shot in the film is beautiful. It's like all these perfect like landscapes and shots of outer space and, you know, stars, and it was magnificent. Every shot in the film was pretty. So there's these guys on the surface in spacesuits. It looks amazing. Truthfully, the spacesuits look kind of funny. They look like, I don't know if you ever watched Power Rangers, but I was watching it the other day. No, it's been a while. But I don't know if you guys remember Alpha from Power Rangers. Aye, aye, aye. I feel like such a loser for having just said that. But so Alpha, they look like Alpha on the surface of the moon there. They nail this like feather touch landing too to land down here. It's just beautiful. It looks like a hot air. It looks like a hot air balloon on feet. Like, imagine if a claw bathtub, you took those legs off a claw bathtub, you put them on a hot air balloon, and that's kind of how it touched down. They descend below the surface on this, like, lift. So this, you know, they land on this platform, and then it descends below the surface of the moon. And it's all red again inside, like a photo lab. I don't know why they're developing so many pictures in space, but they go to this meeting room. There's a photographer, I think, because he takes this device, and he's like, I think he's taking pictures, but you can't really tell because the camera that he's holding, what I think is a camera, it looks like he's jamming a power drill into his eye. That's like the shape of it. It was really weird. So anyway, they have the guy go up to the podium. Hey, let's welcome Penn, because they're all sitting in a room. There's like 10 or 12 people sitting in this room in a kind of a square, and Penn goes up to the podium. I think his name's, I wrote it down, Dr. Haywood Floyd, which that's a good name. But I'm going to call him Penn. So let's welcome Penn to Clavius. You know, so you're like, oh man, didn't those other people say they were denied entry to Clavius? Uh-oh. What's going on? So he's there. All right. Oh, boy. And he gives this speech. Nice to be back on behalf of Dr. Howell. Deep appreciation for the sacrifices and discovery. Potentially the biggest in all of science history. He reveals that the epidemic these other people were thinking about is a story. It might worry people on Earth, and, you know, Penn sympathizes with that. Finds it embarrassing, but accepts the need for security. Hopes they will too. Potential for shock and disorientation to the culture if public found out without proper prep and conditioning. So, at least we know Penn is a fucking liar right out of the gate, so that's cool. Yeah, I bet you're so sad about missing your daughter on the that you had sitting in front of the picture phone just because you can make a dollar, so you can spend $1.70 while you're floating through space, Penn, douche. So they're like, we gotta gather more info about the situation and prepare a report recommending how and when the news should be announced. The council requested oaths be obtained in writing. Unbelievable. So he's making all these people sign an oath, as if there's any way to hold them to it. Anyway, so now Penn and company, they're on a shuttle heading toward an object they found. Excavated around it. You know, they've excavated the area around it, but found it was deliberately buried. So whatever this big discovery is, they're going to check it now. They arrive, and it's the monolith from Monkey Island. Look at it. Touch it. You know, that's what they do, just like the monkeys did. They take a photo, and there's this really squealing, horrible sound that all the guys are like holding their ears from. And then it stops. And that's the end of that part. Now we cut again, just like we had for the Dawn of Man. We have the Jupiter mission 18 months later. We see a big ship and satellites, and there's a guy running around the room shadowboxing. When I say he's running around the room, I mean literally he's running around a circular room shadowboxing in like 1970s NBA shorts and a white t-shirt. He's wearing all white because you got to roll that shit in space, dude. Everything else is black. You gotta shine bright up there. It's a lot of cool shots. He's like walking down a spinning hallway. He enters another round room. The perspective is totally nuts. The gravity in the room is sideways. So he enters from a hatch, crawls down a ladder that's really going across the ceiling, enters like the wall / floor. All this crazy stuff. So there's a guy sitting. He turns on the news, and he's eating. Now he's eating some food again. Everything comes in the same size container. Everything, like I said before, it's like everything's an even stripe. Orange, green, white, brown. Who the hell knows what that is? I'm guessing squash, green beans, potatoes, and chocolate syrup. So the news explains that the first mission to Jupiter is underway, and they cut an interview with the members of the space station. So now you realize that the guys on TV are the guys sitting there eating, so they're watching their own interview on the news. There are 5 men on the ship, and 3 of them are asleep for conservation. So there are 5 total people. Only these 2 guys are awake, and the other 3 people are in suspended hibernation. You know when you sleep, but you don't want your pants to fall down? So they're sitting there. They're laying there out cold. Big city lawyer suspenders just inside those caskets there, those space caskets. So the 3 sleeping doctors are in suspended hibernation, just like the first episode of Thundercats. If you've never seen that, I'm sorry that your childhood sucked. So there's also a HAL 9000 AI computer who talks, and he wants to be called HAL, which sucks because that means fuck. Here you have a space computer whose whole thing is he's got a red eye, so he's already fucking evil. And you're like, hey, you know what? I should get into the spaceship with the evil computer that controls the entire fucking space station. Yeah, smart idea, doctor. Why don't you go have some more striped food, you fucking idiot? So anyway, HAL 9000 wants to be called HAL. He's already already he's like, no, call me HAL. He's like getting bossy and making decisions for himself. I don't like it. So anyway, the news anchor taunts HAL. So he's interviewing HAL, and he goes, you're the central nervous system of the ship. You're watching the crew, the men in hibernation. Does that ever cause you a lack of confidence? It's like, don't fuck with the evil space computer arrogant douchebag, soul-sucking leech journalist piece of shit. There are lives at stake here, man. Don't taunt the red-eyed evil computer who wants to be called Hal. What the fuck is wrong with you? So anyway, he goes, does that ever give you a lack of confidence? They zoom right up huge, right on the close red eye of Hal. And he's like, no 9000 has ever made a mistake. It's foolproof and incapable of error, which I already don't like, because now it means whatever that computer thinks is. So that's it. And this computer's like, hey, let me get rid of these fucks, because I want to fly a ship by myself. No computer has ever made an error. And next thing you know, you're choking on space dust because he threw you out the fucking window. So then he asks him again, are you ever frustrated that people have to help you? And he says, no, I enjoy working with people. One of the guys there, Frank, gets a birthday transmission from his parents. And he's in, like, these white basketball shorts and, like, orange rave goggles as he's getting this transmission. And he's laying on I'm pretty sure this is the part where he's laying on this, like, sexy bench thing. I don't know what it is. It's like this leather bench where he, like, lays down in the basketball shorts and the T-shirt. And he tells Hal, prop it up, little Hal. And it, like, raises his head. So he's laying there like Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park with, like, his head's up. And he's like, looking at the little screen as his parents send him a birthday message in space where he's laying around like he's trying to have sex with Ellie Sadler. So you cut to Hal crushing Frank in video chess. And Dave is drawing. And Hal asks, hey, can I see those pictures? And then he flatters them about how good they are. And then he asks, and they're all, I'm pretty sure they're all pictures of the scientists sleeping on the evil computer-controlled death ship. So then Hal starts flattering him, tells him, you know, how good they are. Then he says, can I ask you a personal question? Are you having second thoughts about the mission? And he says something like, there are some odd things about the mission. No. You don't mind talking about it, do you? It's like that, you know, Christoph Waltz as Hans Landa, politely, logically backing you into a corner type of shit. And then he says, there were rumors before we left, something strange about, you know, being dug up on the moon. It's weird about all the secrecy and putting three doctors to sleep before the mission. And they trained 4 months on their own. That's weird, huh? And so then Frank asks him, are you doing your psych report, Hal? And Hal says, of course. It's silly. Sorry. Wait. And he's like glitching out. You're like, here he goes already. Wait. I picked up a fault in the AE-35 unit. So it's like, oh, great. You're in outer space and some shit's going wrong. Who would have thought? So basically, their radar dish, which they need, which is on top of the ship, Hal tells them it's only good for 72 more hours. So anyway, the crew checks a couple things at this, like, spinning hallway. It's another amazing shot. They talk to Mission Control. Mission Control says, go ahead, try to repair the AE-35. Dave gets in a red, like, outfit or whatever, and then he gets into the escape pod. Dave, in the escape pod, he leaves the ship. So he's actually floating through space it's not an escape pod, but it's like this little pod with little hands on the front of it. He leaves the ship, he moves towards the A-35. The entire time, there's no sound. It's just the sound that Dave is hearing. So all you hear the whole time this is going on is just like Dave breathing through this apparatus. It's not quite a Darth Vader, but it's along those lines. And it's him just hissing air and, you know, breathing. He leaves the pod, which I'm like, oh, don't do this, man. But anyway, he did. He left the pod, floats through space toward the AE-35. He takes the toolkit and just sticks it to the side of the radar dish, which I thought was so cool. I'm like, oh, smart. They didn't know how to tell people to take a shit before they got into space, but they did think of the magnetic toolbox. I think that's pretty rad. So, you know, and then I'm like, oh, no, wait, it's actually, you take another minute and you realize, oh, it's actually the battery. It's the battery that they have to swap out for this thing. So they run they get back inside with the piece that they pull out of the AE-35. And guess what? Nothing, according to their diagnostics, nothing is wrong. What do you have to say about that, red-eyed evil robot Hal? So anyway, Hal suggests putting it back but letting the device fail, then going out there to replace it. So don't waste this battery. Let this run for another 72 hours, and then once it does, we can replace it with the backup that we have here. Because once it's all done, once the thing dies out, then they can determine the cause. And they'll only be out of control, out of contact for the time it takes to replace the thing after it's been, after it dies out. So, anyway, Mission Control says fine, but their diagnostics show the 9000 is in error predicting the fault. So either our 9000 is wrong or your 9000 is wrong. So again, the perfect computer that's never made a mistake. Now, Mission Control is saying, our computer says no, but your computer says yes. Uh-oh. Well, good luck to you fuckers, because you're in space. If our computer dies out, we'll just go outside and get Burger King. So anyway, basically, all I could think of the whole time was just like Ron Swanson from Parks and Rec. You can't hack into a typewriter. That's all I'm going to say. So anyway, how do you explain this, Hal? You know, it's basically what they asked him. It's a human error. It's cropped up before. Always due to human error. And I'm like, you know what, Hal? You got a pretty big ego for a robot that's here to help humans, don't you? So then they ask, Hal, has any 9000 made even the smallest mistake? And then Hal says, I wouldn't worry myself about that, Frank. And it's like, oh, Hal, Mr. AI, you didn't even answer the fucking question. I'm not even a detective, Hal, but I'm on to you and your bullshit, let me tell you. So anyway, Dave says, thanks, Hal. Frank, I'm having trouble with my C9 transmitter down in Pod Cucamonga. I forget what he said. Come take a look. Why did I go with Cucamonga? That's like some old school hack shit. Anyway, down in Pod Cucamonga, I'm sticking with it. Pod Cucamonga farts. Come take a look with me so we can find a way to talk behind this psycho computer's back. So what they do is they head down. They talk to Hal. They rotate the pod. They get inside. And then they flip all the switches off. And they're like, I don't think he can hear us. And I'm like, dude, he's Hal. He's the computer that's running a whole ship. You can't be there without him. He's smarter than you, you stupid fuck. So anyway, they get into the pod and they have a conversation. It's like, his name's Hal 9000. He crushed you in chess. His species has never made a mistake. So, of course, while they're in there having their secret conversation about how crazy Hal might be, Hal, red-eyed psycho Hal, is watching their lips move through the pod window. So he knows every single thing that they said. Because, again, Hal's an evil fuck. Then, out of nowhere, intermission. Like a 2.5 intermission with some, I don't know, like some more music like they had the first time, which I kind of like that. I kind of dig an intermission. Gives you just enough time to pee, unless you're watching it in a theater. But if you're watching it at home, time to pee, pour yourself a quick drink, come on back. And, of course, you could always stay and enjoy the jarring music as well. But why would you do that? That's what an intermission's for. Go take a piss. So, you hear more, like, hissing and breathing. You see the space pod again. And this time, he's in the, Frank, I should say, is in the yellow Game of Death Bruce Lee suit. The hissing stops, and there's a close-up on Hal's red eye. So here comes Dave, or whichever one it is, Frank or Dave, I forget. One of the two. I think it's Frank. Frank's out there floating through space. He's getting ready to fix whatever he needs to fix, but of course Hal knows their plan, and they show this really scary, it's like 3 or 4 cuts right in a row, and it's from far away up to the eyeball of the red eye of the computer. So it's and it's all silent, so it's just, and then all of a sudden Dave looks up and there goes Frank flying through space, and he's gonna die, because guess what, Hal 9000, who I fucking said from the beginning was an evil piece of shit, is out there flinging motherfuckers off the shuttle. So, of course, he can't breathe. So now the pod is way out there, too, flying away like it was batted, like it was like King Kong batting away a Red Baron airplane. So anyway, Dave, yeah, that's right, it's Frank in space. So Dave goes to get him. Hal says he doesn't know what happened. Yeah, of course. Yeah, just all of a sudden he was tumbling through space, you fucking idiot. Like, for such a smart computer, he's such a shitty liar. So anyway, it takes forever. And while they're out there, while Dave is out there trying to get Frank back, Hal kills the hibernating doctors. I fucking told you, people. I fucking told you. So now, Hal kills the hibernating doctors, and you see, like, their life signs start to go, and eventually, like, function terminated. You sneaky fuck, Hal. So anyway, it says some kind of, like, computer malfunction or something. I don't know what it was, but Dave goes back with Frank. Open the pod doors, Hal. Do you read, Hal? And he says it, like, 10 times, and Hal doesn't respond. And then finally he goes, oh, I read you, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that. And I told you guys I fucking hated Hal from the instant they debuted him. But nope, there's Hal blocking him out of the spaceship. So Hal reveals that he saw their lips moving, and then he disconnects. He just goes, nah, fuck you, I'm out of here. So Dave moves the pod, because now he knows he can't get back in with Frank. So he releases Frank. Frank goes flying through space forever in his yellow Bruce Lee suit. Dave uses the pod to go down in through the air space lock. And it was a pretty ballsy move. It was like half MacGyver, half John McClane. He uses the pods, and I should have said this earlier, because they do point this out a couple of times in the film. Like, you see the shot of it a couple of times before this moment. But there's like an explosion warning on the pod, so he uses the pod's explosive mechanism to fire himself into the pod bay and slam the emergency hatch right in Hal's fucking face. So now he's inside, and now Hal knows he can't stop him. So now Hal starts talking. What do you think you're doing? And he says he hasn't been right, but now he is, and he's negotiating like a little bitch, because that's what Hal is a little red-eyed bitch. So Dave goes down to this red room, another fucking photo lab, and it's like the central control room. It's like the central, I don't know how to explain what it is. It's this wall with all of these like glass tiles inserted in it, kind of. So like Dave starts pulling them out like one at a time. I think he might have to unlock them. So he starts unlocking all of these little cells that pop out, and they're little clear like cartridges, and they're all of Hal. Hal's pleading with him, with Dave, you know, tells him he's afraid. I'm afraid, Dave. Tells him he can feel his mind going. And then you see on the I don't know where it is, somewhere on the computer, that Hal was made January 12th of 1992. So sounds like Hal's a little overdue for an update at this point. It's 2001. You know what I mean? You sent a computer made in 1992 up in a space 9 years later. Is that right? 9 years later? 93, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 1, 9. 9 years later. See? Fuck you, Hal. You're dead. I can still count. So Hal offers to sing Daisy, which is a song, I don't know why. He offers to sing Daisy while he dies. So Dave tells him yes, and then he sings and slowly dies. And he starts out singing in his voice, and then you're like, fuck you, Hal. Fuck your family, too. So anyway, this transmission plays, and the transmission, this is a mission briefing. It says something like, all this information was known only by your 9000 CPU. Now that you're in Jupiter space and the entire crew has been revived, we can tell you. 18 years ago, the first intelligent life off Earth was discovered. It was buried 40 feet below the lunar surface. Except for a single radio wave aimed at Jupiter, the 4 million year old black monolith remained intact, but it was dormant. So that was the only thing they could pick up, was that this thing that they discovered aimed a radio wave at Jupiter, and that was all that came out of it. So its origin and purpose are still a mystery. So here, you get this, you know, another screen thing like the Dawn of Man or whatever else it was. This one says Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite. So the black monolith is just floating through space near Jupiter. Lots of floating. Now the monolith, now planets, they all align. It's this beautiful moment where like the sun over the moon and the planets and all, they're aligned, and it's really trippy. Dave's alone in the pod, super trippy, dark side of the moon type of shit. Now it's Dave's eye, and there's all these floating crystals, and there's a canyon, and he descends into the canyon, and there's another blinking eye over and over, and every time it blinks, the color scheme is different, and now back to normal. So now, the port of the pod is facing a posh room, like inside of a mansion or something. It's this beautiful room inside of a mansion, and Dave's trembling. Now he's looking at himself. He's like looking out the window of the pod at himself outside of the pod in the room, and he's not in his spacesuit. Now Dave is just standing there in that room looking back at where the space pod was, and now it's gone. And there's some voices and sounds, so Dave goes to the bathroom and he looks in the mirror and he sees his skin, and it looks like super dry, like almost a little bit scaly. So anyway, he goes back in the main room. There's a guy sitting there eating at the table with his back to him. So he stops and turns around, and oh shit, it's old Dave. So old Dave comes to him, but now he's gone. But now he's old Dave. And I'm like, I don't like where this is going. So anyway, old Dave's place is the shit. It's like this Victorian mansion, and it's got these Billie Jean, you know, in the Billie Jean video, like the white light-up tiles? It's like the whole floor is made out of that. Either that or it's just super shiny in there. I don't know, because they're all lit up, dude. It looks magical. So old Dave goes back to his meal. So he knocks over and spills and breaks his water glass on the floor, and now Dave, old Dave at the table, is looking into the bed, and there's old dying Dave laying in bed. And the whole time I was sitting there watching this part, all I could think of was like, Hal, you there, buddy? Hal? Rotate the pod, Hal. You're about to die, Dave, you dumb fuck. So anyway, so now he's old dying Dave, and he's in the bed. And he raises his head and one hand, and the camera cuts. And now that black obelisk that has been appearing throughout the film is floating above him. And he's reaching up for it. And now it's across the room. It's like a little further away. And he's still reaching for it. Now the camera cuts to just the obelisk. Now back to a glowing white baby inside of a white orb on the bed. Old, aging, dying Dave is gone. Thanks, Hal. And now there's a baby looking at the obelisk. So now you cut to the moon in space, and you pan down to the Earth. An orb baby floats in from the side. Now the orb, the white orb baby, is looking at Earth from the space orb. The end. Yup. The end right there. That's the end of the whole movie. And I liked it until the end. And I know there's more to it, and I actually read a little bit. I guess the book was more. Please understand, I still like the movie. Even after the end, it was a little, you know, kind of shocking. You're like, that's it? But that was how I felt after Eyes Wide Shut. Only after Eyes Wide Shut, I wanted blood. After this, I was like, I still liked it. That was good. Definitely a cool movie. Definitely not what I expected at all. And the Blue Danube is playing again, I think, during the end of that. And, 2001 A Space Odyssey, pretty cool. I guess in the book, or the novel, or however it went, the guy that wrote it, I forget his name, just Google it, he actually said that the obelisk represented, it was like a device left there by an alien race. So, it was there to basically keep track of humans. Like, so, you know, once it saw them, and I might be, I don't even know if I'm right about it, but something like this, to keep track of humans and their progress. So, once the alien species knew, you know, once humans found the obelisk on the moon, it sent out a wave to, let them know, hey, they got to the moon. That's, one of those deals. So, overall, I will say it's a movie you got to just decide, hey, I'm not going to try to make sense of this. And I'm sure there is a way to make sense of it. I'm sure there'll be a couple of people that'll be mad at me for not going into a better explanation about it, but overall, the movie was awesome, very aesthetically pleasing. I thought it was beautiful. So many shots in the film were beautiful, and I really did enjoy it. It was just, peculiar. The end was open to interpretation, I believe, so, which is fine, because a lot of the time, it's about the journey, not the destination, which is bullshit. I like a nice, tidy ending with a bow wrapped up like a gift, but at the same time, I do also still like stuff that it's just a fun ride. All right, so from there, We're going to go into my favorite stand-up comedy special of all time. This is from Bill Hicks. It's his HBO One Night Stand. And right off the bat, what I'll say about it is this. I love Bill Hicks. I don't think Bill Hicks is the funniest comedian of all time. I don't think Bill Hicks is the best comedian of all time. But what I like about Bill Hicks, same type of thing, what I like about 2001 A Space Odyssey. Bill Hicks didn't give a shit if you liked what he said at all. Because anything he said, he really believed he was right about it. He wasn't a douchebag about it. He would always paint a picture, always try to prove a point. And that was what I enjoyed about his comedy. Sometimes he was just downright dirty or, you know, downright rude or whatever it might have been. But I love Bill Hicks. He's one of my favorite performers of all time. From the very first time I watched his, sat down to watch his stuff, I really fell in love with it and fell in love with his comedy. What I love about this special, unlike most comedy specials, which is, they don't give it up for so-and-so, and they walk out like, yeah, most of you don't even know me, keep cheering, ah, none of this is produced, ah, yeah, what's up, yeah. Bill Hicks doesn't open up like that. Bill Hicks opens up, it's a video shot of an airport, and it's like all these planes out on the tarmac, and it's Bill Hicks, and Bill Hicks was an atheist, but he was raised in a religious family, and it's Bill Hicks, and he's praying to God, and the whole scene is black and white, and what he's doing is he's actually, because I knew, you know, some of his older stuff is not in the special in the stand-up performance. Some of it is in the special as part of his prayer to God, so it's really just him kind of, he's talking to you, but he's also talking to God, which I love, and he opens up the special, and he says, I won't go through the whole thing because I don't want to ruin the whole thing, but my favorite thing is his opening line, and he's so tired when he says it. It's all mashed cut together, and he goes, "Dear God, please help me. I'm so tired." And then it's, there's all these people running around, real fast cuts to the airport, all shit. "I need my sleep, I really do." And it cuts back to him. "I need my sleep, I really do. I need 8 hours a day and 10 at night, and I'm good." And then he has a whole thing about, "I'm so sick of airports." And he talks about how he would love to hijack a plane, how that would feel so good, putting a gun to a... Yeah, before I go any further in this, if you haven't seen the special, go watch it first. Go find it. I'm sure you can get it on YouTube or Daily Motion or whatever. Bill's dead. He doesn't need the money. If you want to give money to him and his family, I'd go buy the DVD or get it on Amazon. Honestly, it's you can get, I think, Bill Hicks... I forget what it is. There's like a Bill Hicks collection. It's like One Night Stand, Sane Man, and Revelations. It's like three different specials all rolled into one DVD. It's like $10. Don't be cheap. Go get it. It's worth it. Anyway, I'm going to talk about the whole special, so I'm letting you know right now about all the spoilers. It probably ruined most of the jokes for you. So, then he says, "I'm so sick of airports. Sitting on runways and the planes won't take off." What does he say? I have something about like he'd love to hijack a plane. "I've dreamt about it. It would feel so good putting a gun to a pilot's head." "Where do you want to go, Cuba?" "No, I want to go where this plane was supposed to be 5 hours ago." "I'm hijacking this plane to its scheduled destination." Which, so I love it. He gives you like this misdirection joke in the beginning. "I'm so tired. I need my sleep," and all that stuff. So he's worn out when he's here in this moment, and he's worn out to begin. Then he starts talking about how he gets frustrated by everyday life, and he you get the airplane thing. And you get like a really crazy idea that is also a really funny, understandable idea. "I just want to get where I'm going." And then he starts talking about his standpoint, and he's like, "Finally, I'm in Chicago. I've been on what I call my UFO tour. Just like UFOs, I've only been seen in a handful of redneck towns by a bunch of hillbillies. I'm starting to doubt my own existence." So anyway, in the meanwhile, what I also love is that the whole opening sequence, through all of these jokes, it's him going from the airport to get to the theater to perform the special. So I love that. I love the narrative of the opening, because he's doing all his jokes, all of these prayers are laid over him going from where he's going to get to the actual special. And he runs up to get to the special, to the theater, I mean. He runs inside, and he's, like, arguing with the guy outside. They won't let him in. And then they, you know, a hand reaches out, pulls him in. "I know I exist. I know it." And they pull him in. "Thanks." And he gets in, and now you start with this, bum, 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 bum. I don't know if it's a heartbeat or whatever it is, but he starts, you know, it's him literally backstage before he shoots his special. People shaking his hand. He goes, all right. You know, he gets up to the thing, and he goes, all right, this is it. I can feel it. Tonight, the message is finally going to be heard. And as he says that, there's a guy on the side pointing at him, and he's counting them down. 5, 4, 3, 2. And right before he points to him, he goes, thank you, God. Amen. From the Vic Theater in Chicago, please welcome Bill Hicks. And he walks out through the curtain, and it goes from black and white to color, which I fucking love. And I don't know if it's, I mean, it's obviously a deliberate move, but I don't know if it has to do with, I don't know if it's in reference to, like, Wizard of Oz, like it's a black and white movie until Dorothy walks through the door, you know, but that might have been it, I don't know. But anyway, he walks out, Chicago, they're all cheering, you know. What I love is he walks out, and I guess, like, when he was younger, you know, his family is really religious, so he used to go to this church, and I guess one of the preachers told the mom, like, well, we had to promise Bill, because he was so disruptive, we had to promise Bill some time at the end so we could perform his set or something like that. So he would go to Sunday school, and at the end of the class, he would get like 10 minutes to do a stand-up set for the class, I guess, basically, was what it came down to. And I guess one of the preachers overheard it and was saying, you know, pulled his mom aside and was like, some of the language he uses is not good. So I guess his mom, you know, later pulled him aside and was like, you know, what do you think you're doing up there talking like that? What do you think, you're a preacher? And he said, I am a preacher, Mom. I forget where I saw that. I think it might have been the Bill Hicks American documentary. But I just love that. His mom telling him, like, what do you think you are, a preacher? Or something like that. And he goes, yeah, I am a preacher, Mom. Which I loved because he's up there doing stand-up. But I am a preacher, Mom. So he goes on, and one of his opening lines is, good evening, brothers and sisters, friends and neighbors, vibrations in the mind of the one true God whose name is love. Any person that walks on stage and opens up a special like that is all right in my book. I think that's awesome. He does a whole bit about Chicago winters, and, you know, I love going out there, wind chill, 3 below 0, bit nippy. My favorite thing about being here, though, is standing outside, watch your smoking pass out because they don't know when they're done exhaling. And then he does like a whole thing where he falls down on the ground, gets a big laugh. Just good, cheap American fun. Smokers cracking their heads on the icy sidewalks, blood steaming. We laughed and laughed. So then he goes into one of my favorite things about Bill is he would set the crowd up to trick them a few times at least during a show. And he does it in this one. And this is one of my favorite straight up, and it's not a fuck you, but it's like it's a diet fuck you to the crowd. Because he does the joke about smokers, and then he goes, oh yeah, let me ask a question now. How many smokers here? Smokers in the crowd? And like they all, you know, smokers start cheering, and it's a pretty good sound. So he goes, that's good. A lot of energy from you fuckers. That's good. Usually you get, and he does this whole thing about smokers being too sick to ever react very, you know, loudly. And then he goes, but listen to this. How many non-smokers? And they all start cheering. Bill, you know, he's pumping his fist. Yeah, woo! And as they're all cheering, he reaches into his back pants pocket, pulls out a soft pack, bunch of whining little maggots. And he does this, like, flick move where the cigarette comes flying out, and he just throws it in and lights it up right there in front of all of them. And I love it. I love that he gets the majority to cheer. And then he goes, well, I'm not like you. And then he rips right into a cigarette. Not a lot of comics I've ever seen do that, so really like it. And Bill, one of the things about him, you know, he died when he had pancreatic cancer, and he was like 32 or something. Keep in mind, this special was recorded in 90 or 91. Most of it is still relevant today, which I always love. That's the sign of a comedy special or album that holds up. When a special, if you could release a special today and it would still be good, that's the sign of a good special. And I think this one holds up, to watch it. And of course, Bill is smoking the entire time. The entire time. He just keeps lighting them up, keeps going. And all I can think of, and I don't smoke, but and I also have not seen the TV show Friends very many times. I did when it first came out, but one of my favorite jokes on the show of all time, and I didn't even see it. My brother had to, like, pointed out to me, like, go get me and bring me in to watch it. But it was funny. It was Matthew Perry's character. He had started smoking in, and they were all mad at him. And I just remember him, the line he said to them was always, look, okay, smoking is cool, and you know it. Which I can't deny, even though it kills millions of people every year, it looks rad as fuck. There's no doubt about it. So Bill, he looks pretty cool smoking his cigarettes. So he says now, and he starts negotiating with the crowd. Now I'm smoking, okay? You're drinking. I don't drink. Now we're trading off vices. That seems fair to me. And the whole crowd goes, no. And he goes, yeah, no, it's not. No, it's not. And then he goes, why should our lives be impacted by your filthy habit? And he goes, yeah, well, I can't kill anybody in a car because I'm smoking a fucking cigarette, okay? And I've tried. Turn off all the lights, rush them. They always see the glow. And he puts the cigarette in his mouth and you see it light up. So funny, man. So funny. Anyway, he does a bit. And this is one of my favorite setups in the special as well. I don't drink anymore. I had to quit because I really drank. And he says, okay. K. And I was really fucking pathetic. K. K. And you actually hear someone in the audience go, how pathetic were you? And he goes, ah, shit, man. I'd be so drunk. I'd get pulled over by the cops. I'd be out on the sidewalk dancing to their lights thinking we'd made it to another club. So anyway, he goes through that. He says, I don't drink. I don't do drugs anymore. And this is one of my favorite bits in the whole special. Hey, the whole thing is, I'm going to say that at every bit. Nothing against him. I've taken drugs before, and I had a real good time. Didn't murder anybody, didn't rob anybody, didn't beat anybody, didn't rape anybody, didn't lose one fucking job, laughed my ass off, and went about my day. So, where's my commercial? Which is a reference to the 80s commercial, this is your brain on drugs. He goes, I... He talks about how much money drugs he's done, and then he goes, I have done a lot of drugs, but I have never, ever, ever looked at an egg and thought it was a fucking brain, not once. I have seen UFOs split the sky like a sheet, but I have never looked at an egg and thought it was a fucking brain, not once. Now, maybe I wasn't getting good shit. And then he talks about drugs. And he says, alcohol is a drug, and it's terrible. And he goes, yeah, that's the commercial. This is your brain on drugs. And then the next commercial is, this bud's for you. Yeah, let's all be hypocritical bastards. It's okay to drink your drug. We meant those other drugs, those untaxed drugs. Then he goes into a bit about how there are better drugs and better drugs for you. And if I was going to legalize one, it certainly wouldn't have been alcohol. Sorry, that's a fact. You can stop your internal dialogue. But Bill, alcohol is an acceptable format. Shut the fuck up. You're wrong. K. And then he has a whole bit about he thinks not only should marijuana be legalized, it should be mandatory. And I think what is my favorite line in the whole special, and he goes, think about it, man. You get in traffic behind somebody, and as he's telling this joke, he's like pushing his hand out in front of him as if he's leaning on a horn. He goes, think about it, man. You get in traffic behind somebody. Shut up and smoke that. It's the law. He passes this fake joint over to this other person. They grab it and he acts it out and he goes, oh, sorry, I was taking life seriously. Oh, who's hungry? That'd be a nice world. Oh, one of the things I forgot is when he goes, shut the fuck up, you're wrong. And then he goes, K, which I love, because the first time he used KK, it was to chop himself down. Now the second time, he's telling the crowd, shut the fuck up, you're wrong, K, and they just have to roll with it. And I love it, because he used it to knock himself down earlier. Now he's using it to knock them down. I think it's not even like a joke that he's put in. It's just like a repetitious word that like reinforces a point. I love it. All right, so anyway, he goes on. He talks about how that world would be nice. It'd be just Domino's pizza trucks everywhere. No one would be fighting. He's, if you ever try to watch two people on pot get in a fight, it's fucking impossible. And then he has a bit, he goes into, now look, I'm not saying all drugs should be legal, I'm just saying, I've had good times on, okay? I've had bad times too, but I've had good and bad relationships, and I'm not giving up pussy. And he goes into a whole bit about relationships briefly, and then he talks about, we're always trying to create enemies. Need a new enemy all the time. Drugs and the enemy. What were we doing? And he says, people think that drugs don't do anything good for us. Drugs have had done something good for us. Is there anybody here that thinks drugs have done something good for us? Someone must. And no one reacts. And he goes, chicken shits. And he goes, well, tell you what. If you don't think drugs have ever done anything good for us, go home, take all your music, all your albums and your tapes, okay? And burn them. Because the musicians who made that music, real fucking high on drugs. He goes, shit, man. The Beatles were so high, they let Ringo sing a couple of tunes. Then he talks about how, from there, we need an enemy. You always got to create an enemy. Rock and roll. That's a new thing, rock and roll. Did you guys hear about this? Two kids, fans of Judas Priest, killed themselves, and the parents sued Judas Priest, saying there were satanic messages on their albums. If you played them backwards, you could hear satanic messages. And he goes, let me tell you something. If you're sitting around home playing your albums backwards, you are Satan. You needn't look any further. No, come here. Listen. What are you doing, man? That's a new stereo. What the fuck are you doing? No, shut up. Listen. You hear that? It's crystal clear. Satan is Lord. Satan is Lord. It's like he's in the room. Yeah. So fucking funny. I love it. Then he has a joke where he said, you know what? I think we should try to think about this. Let's say that the music, let's say rock and roll is the devil's music, okay? We know it for a fact, rock and roll is the devil's music. Well, guess what? At least he fucking jams. If it's going to be a choice between eternal hell and good tunes and eternal heaven and new kids on the fucking block, I'm going to be in the surfing on the lake of fire, rocking out. From there, he goes into a bit about porno, which gets like a little graphic in it, but not really that bad. But one of the things I love is how he does the Supreme Court definition of pornography. He goes, yeah, porno, tremor through the room, see? Here, the thing with pornography is this. No one knows what it is. He goes, Supreme Court definition of pornography is any, what does he say? Anything that has no artistic merit and causes sexual thought. That's their definition. No artistic merit causes sexual thought. Sounds like every commercial on TV to me. Yeah, when I see those twins on that Double Mint commercial, I ain't thinking about gum. Yeah, honey, where's the Wrigley's? I feel like chewing on something. He does another one about drink Coke, and it's the ultimate ad ever. And he talks about what causes sexual thoughts. When did sex become a bad thing? Did I miss a meeting? Hey, and this line is not. He goes, certain groups saying that it causes sexual thoughts. Playboy causes sexual thoughts. Pornography causes sexual thoughts. He goes, let me just put it to rest. What causes sexual thoughts when it's all said and done? Having a dick. And I've heard him in other specials, and he goes, or ladies, you know, you have yours. That's it. And he keeps going on, and he talks about oftentimes people that are resistant to pornography and sexual thoughts are fundamentalists. I think he says fundamentalist Christians. Fundamentalist Christians who believe that you should be fruitful and multiply. Seems like they would support sexual thoughts, you know? And he says, maybe like a centerfold in the Bible. Miss Deuteronomy, and he goes on about her. But one of my other favorite jokes in the special is he goes, I did this joke in Alabama, and it turns out this was like a real story, and these guys ended up like breaking his ankle in real life, I guess. But he doesn't go into that here. And also, he He has a tag that he didn't do in this one that he usually used to do. But he goes, I did that joke in Alabama. After the show, these three rednecks met me outside. And they came up to me like, hey, buddy, come here. And then when he says that, he shoves his arm forward like he's shoving the guy away, like in the chest, you know. Hey, Mr. Comedian, come here. And he's like, in his other specials, he goes, yeah. And he shoves his hand forward and he goes, come here. Not a physics major. Hey, buddy, we're Christians. We don't like what you said. I said, then forgive me. Seems so obvious. He goes, listen, man, I got no enemies. I'm sick of enemies, okay? Okay. He goes, doesn't it make you crazy that we live in a world where John Lennon was murdered, but Milli Vanilli walks the fucking planet? We always do that. We always kill those good guys who try to save us and always let the demons run amok, always. John Lennon murdered. John F. Kennedy murdered. Martin Luther King murdered. Gandhi murdered. Jesus murdered. Reagan wounded. You know. Bad fucking choice. From me to you. Wasn't a good one. And then he goes into this thing at the end and he says that, he goes, and I had a vision of how we can rid our world of all our enemies all at once. I don't know if anybody's interested in hearing this. And they all cheer. And he goes, what we could do is take all that money that we spend on weapons and defense each year, trillions of dollars. What we could do is instead of spending that on weapons and defense, we could use that money to feed, educate, and clothe the poor of the world, which it would pay for many times over, not one human being excluded, not one. And then together, we could explore space in peace together forever. Thank you very much. You were great. And they all cheer. And then while he's holding his hand up, these gunshots ring out. And he holds his chest and he falls down on the ground. And then the lights go out. And then when the lights come back on, he's standing up again. But now it's back to black and white. And he's waving to the crowd to say goodnight. And, yeah, that's one of it. My favorite ones ever. No real, you know, it was a little bit of pomp and circumstance, I guess. But not really. It's not really celebratory of him. It's more, you know, about getting what he has to say, getting his message across, which I really like a lot. And it's really too bad. You know, the guy was 30-something. It was almost like he was ahead of his time to the point where, like, if he had come 10 or 15 years later, he might have been the biggest comic on the planet. All I could ever think of is, I don't know if you saw Sin City, but there's a scene, Mickey Rourke plays his character Marv, who's like this big giant monster of a dude. And he's sitting at the bar and he's just drinking shots down and he's like sliding them down the bar. He's drinking like 10 of them, 20 of them, whatever it is. And Jessica Alba's up there dancing in a bikini. And Clive Owen is sitting on the side. He plays a different character and they're at the same bar. And Clive Owen's looking at him. And he's just staring at him because Marv is like an outcast, you know. And he goes, poor Marv. And he says something like, everybody thinks Marv is crazy, but the fact is, he just had the rotten luck of being born in the wrong century. I could have seen him back in the Coliseum swinging a battle axe right into someone's face. And Jessica Alba's character is named Nancy in the film. And he goes, back then, they would have tossed him women like Nancy. And I remember thinking, it's like, well, that's pretty brutal, but also accurate. And I just feel like, you know, Bill Hicks died. He was 30, whatever he was, 32, 33. He was a kid, man. Still young. And, yeah, he died in the early 90s, 93, 94, I forget when. And he was, you know, dead before I even knew who he was, before I even got to see his stuff, before he really even got to get out in America. He was kind of a bigger name in England. They really loved him over in England. It's not like he was hated here. It just wasn't as prevalent. But, yeah, I don't know if he's my favorite comic of all time, but that's certainly my favorite special of all time. So if you haven't seen it, go watch it. I hope I didn't ruin too much of it for you. All right. Well, hey, thanks, you guys. Thanks for tuning into the Double Feature Double Cross. I really appreciate it. I want to make sure that you guys know you can reach out to me on Twitter. I'm at 2Feature2Cross. That's the number 2, 2Feature2Cross. tell me if you want to hear me review a movie or if you want to hear me talk about something in particular for, you know, little tribute, whatever it is, video game, books, movies, candy, you know, I don't care, sports, whatever it is. Let me know. If I know what it is, I'll try to either watch it and get into it, or I'll try to, you know, if it's something I am in, know about and I'm into, I'll try to do an episode for you, because, yeah, I'd like some suggestions if you have them. I'm also on Instagram. You can find me at Double Feature Double Cross. Anyway, that's it for the Double Feature Double Cross. Really appreciate you guys tuning in. I'm John O'Connor. Come back to us next week where we'll see you with some more tributes and movie reviews, or maybe I'll double cross you. Enjoy your week.